Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. It's part of the Arizona Watchdog Project. Tom Homan once spared Phoenix migrants. Now he's Trump's Darth Vader. This story was written by Stephen Lemons and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on July 28th. Standing in front of a joint session of the Arizona legislature in April, Tom Homan played the hits. During a nearly 30-minute address, punctuated with occasional profanity, Donald Trump's so-called border czar spouted the same crude bluster, defiance, and dime store machismo that have become the hallmarks of his public appearances. He's boasted about being entrusted to lead the largest deportation operation in this country's history. He told undocumented immigrants that they should be looking over your shoulder. When Democrats filed out of the room at the beginning of his speech, carrying sheets of paper with the names of people they said were disappeared by the Trump administration, Homan beamed with bravado. "Thank you for making my day," Homan told them with a smile as they filed out. "I love haters. They make my day every day." In the second Trump administration, Homan seems to be enjoying all the attention that helming a cruel and chaotic mass deportation scheme has afforded him. The 63-year-old, that's a year younger than George Clooney, though Homan appears a million miles older, has become a mainstay of conservative media. He threatens to arrest Democratic lawmakers who oppose the actions of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, whom he's let off the leash. He gloats over the abduction and removal of non-criminal migrants to foreign gulags. He peddles bullshit about the doxing of ICE agents to justify hiding their identities. Ironically, considering how much his agents conceal their faces, Homan's love of the MAGA spotlight has made his craggy visage one of the most recognizable among Trump's cronies. Homan wasn't always like this, though. Trump's deportation attack dog has spent decades in immigration enforcement, many of them in Phoenix. He has worked under Republican and Democratic presidents, dutifully enacting the immigration agendas of both, even when they weren't drippingly inhumane. In fact, according to both former colleagues and court documents, Homan was once something too few in Trump's orbit are these days. Reasonable. Phoenix New Times spoke to several former colleagues of Homan, who knew him while he served as the executive assistant director of ICE's enforcement and removal operations under Barack Obama. They spoke to New Times on condition of anonymity, citing Homan's and the Trump administration's power and penchant for deploying the might of the federal government in retaliation against critics. They believe Homan was a different man then, a man who abhorred Donald Trump and didn't believe that every undocumented immigrant represented a mortal threat to the country. He even intervened on behalf of immigrants arrested by notorious former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, they say, saving hundreds of them from deportation. The accounts of these former colleagues find support both in court records and in Homan's own statements before Congress and elsewhere. And they wonder what changed. Is Homan simply a hack, a hypocritical apparatchik of the Trump era, for whom conscience and morality are as malleable as Mr. Fantastic? Did his worldview fundamentally change after leaving Obama's employ? Or has Homan finally found his Emperor Palpatine in Trump, so seduced by the power of the MAGA dark side that he's willing to justify any act? Prosecutorial discretion. By his own admission, Homan's ties to Phoenix run deep. As such, he's left a trail of decisions here that belie his hard-ass persona. After starting in law enforcement as a cop in his hometown of West Carthage, New York, Homan joined the Border Patrol in 1984. Initially assigned to the San Diego sector, he worked his way up to conducting investigations as a special agent for what was then known as the Immigration and Naturalization Service. In his 2020 book, Defend the Border and Save Lives, Homan wrote that he spent a major portion of my time as a special agent investigating and prosecuting alien smuggling and human trafficking organizations in Phoenix. When Congress folded INS into the newly formed Department of Homeland Security after 9/11, Homan rose to the position of supervisor, directing investigative agents within ICE. In early 2013, after nearly three decades in immigration enforcement, Homan got the call from Obama to lead enforcement and removal operations, the arm of ICE responsible for arresting and removing people who don't have the legal authority to be in the country. Though the Obama administration did plenty of that, earning Obama the sobriquet Deporter-in-Chief, those who knew Homan at the time said he did not strike them as an anti-immigration zealot. Homan was a valued colleague, they said, enforcement-minded, but compassionate, someone who embraced common sense when it came to immigration issues. I considered him to be thoughtful, one said. I considered him to want to do the right thing and what was best for Arizona. Though many right-wingers in the state disagreed, the best thing for Arizona wasn't snatching up and deporting every otherwise law-abiding, undocumented immigrant ICE could lay its hands on. The official policy of the federal government at the time was outlined in two 2011 memos from then ICE Director John Morton. ICE would exercise prosecutorial discretion, Morton wrote, considering factors such as a person's criminal history, or whether someone poses a national security or public safety concern when deciding whether or not to question, detain, or remove an immigrant. Aliens suspected of terrorism or espionage were at the top of Morton's removal list. Next were so-called criminal aliens, with those convicted of aggravated felonies prioritized for removal over those with misdemeanors. Though Homan now says any immigrant is fair game, if you're in the country illegally, you're not off the table, he told Arizona lawmakers. His past associates said he wholeheartedly supported using prosecutorial discretion. I don't know if he had a soft heart so much as I think he accepted the philosophy in the Obama administration, one colleague said, which was that if you can only deport 400,000 people, you go for the 400,000 worst, which is only a very small percentage of what you encounter. That certainly isn't ICE's modus operandi these days. Homan and others have claimed that the administration is targeting the worst of the worst, but there's vast evidence to the contrary. One estimate found that nearly 72% of those detained by immigration authorities since Trump took office have never been convicted of a crime. Speaking at the Arizona legislature, Homan blamed the detention of so many collaterals on so-called sanctuary cities, though the steady stream of stories about otherwise innocent people snapped up by ICE, some undocumented, some with protected status, and even some U.S. citizens, suggests that collaterals haven't really been collateral at all. Homan once vigorously defended the discretionary enforcement policy, at which he now sneers. During 2013 testimony before a congressional subcommittee, Homan called prosecutorial discretion smart and effective law enforcement. ICE had removed 410,000 people in 2012, he noted, most of whom met the agency's enforcement priorities. 55% were criminal aliens, a rate the current administration isn't even within shouting distance of reaching, while most of the rest had orders of removal or had recently and illegally crossed the border. Such successes could not have been achieved, he added, without the policies issued by Morton and then Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. What's more, Homan's ERO division played a role in reining in one of Trump's biggest immigration allies, a man Homan warmly praised during his speech to the Arizona legislature earlier this year, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Cutting illegals a break. Arpaio was a problem for the Obama administration. For years, the swaggering Arizona sheriff had earned the ire of Democrats and progressive activists for turning his agency into a mini-ICE, terrorizing local immigrants with large-scale sweeps of Latino neighborhoods and worksite raids. ICE and Arpaio initially worked hand-in-hand. Through the 287G program, 160 sheriff's deputies were cross-deputized as ICE agents in the early 2000s. But by the time Homan became top dog at ERO in 2013, the Obama administration was slowly boxing Arpaio in. In 2009, DHS stripped Arpaio's deputies of the power to enforce federal immigration law, though that hardly slowed them. 2 years later, the Justice Department issued a 22-page report accusing the sheriff's office of biased policing toward Latinos, eventually suing Arpaio for the same reasons. Civil rights groups also took Arpaio to court. As a result, a federal judge eventually found the sheriff's office guilty of widespread racial profiling, imposing independent monitoring of the agency that continues to this day. Despite that, ICE had still been detaining and deporting immigrants Arpaio had caught in his illegal dragnets. At the time, immigrants were subject to a sinister scheme in which ICE lawyers trained Maricopa County prosecutors on how to make sure the poor saps collared in Arpaio's employment raids were deported. Under immigrant stalwart County Prosecutor Andrew Thomas, who was disbarred in 2012 for prosecutorial misconduct, and his successor Bill Montgomery, now an Arizona Supreme Court justice, prosecutors hit undocumented workers with Class 4 felonies for ID theft for using fake IDs to obtain work. That made them non-bondable under voter-approved Proposition 100, which denied bail to undocumented immigrants accused of certain crimes. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 2014 struck down Proposition 100 as unconstitutional, but not before county prosecutors foisted a Hobson's choice upon Arpaio's arrestees. Plead guilty to a lesser charge involving criminal impersonation, or remain in jail and fight a losing battle. The catch? The lesser charge would ensure their deportation and a 10-year bar from reentry, because ICE considered it a crime involving moral turpitude. According to Homan's former colleagues, he eventually came around to the position that the cases were tainted due to the racial profiling accusations against Arpaio. Ultimately, these associates believe Homan's legal advisors convinced him that if Arpaio's raids and arrests proved to be unconstitutional and racially motivated, then ICE should not use those convictions to remove those he arrested from the country. That pipeline of people being arrested by the sheriff and prosecuted by MCAO and then going over to ICE was shut down, one associate said. Their immigration cases were dismissed without prejudice. New Times was unable to reach Homan through ICE, the White House, or even his publicist. Given the reluctance of those in the know to go on the record, verifying that Homan intervened to assist hundreds of criminal aliens in avoiding deportation might seem a tall order. That is, were it not for a lawsuit brought in 2014 by a high-ranking ICE attorney against then-Homeland Security Secretary Jed Johnson, Homan's boss at the time. The lawsuit was brought by Pat Vroom, then the chief counsel for ICE in Arizona. She'd enjoyed a stellar 30-year career as a government attorney until internal politics at the agency got the better of her. Her complaint dealt mainly with alleged age and sex discrimination. In 2015, the government paid her nearly $400,000 to end the suit. But part of the suit dealt with the Arizona Identity Theft Initiative. Vroom was tasked with reviewing the immigration files of hundreds of detainees who had been convicted of low-level identity theft under Arizona law. Specifically, Vroom was told to look carefully at the cases and consider them for administrative closure, a form of dismissal that would allow the individual to be released from ICE custody. According to the suit, Vroom's superiors explained to her that the typical alien defendant convicted under these provisions of Arizona criminal law had simply been using a fake ID to get and keep employment. Working with ICE's local official in charge of removals, Vroom reviewed 480 cases in 2013, weighing the history of each case, the arresting agency, whether the false identity belonged to a real person, and if so, if that real person had suffered any permanent loss as a result. In other words, prosecutorial discretion. ICE wouldn't waste time on low-level offenders just trying to work when there were more serious criminals to target. In May 2014, according to her complaint, both Vroom and her local ERO counterpart received awards from the State Bar of Arizona for their joint implementation of former ICE Director John Morton's prosecutorial discretion initiatives. Homan was not part to Vroom's suit, nor does his name appear in it. But Homan's ex-colleagues say it is impossible that he was unaware of ICE's Arizona Identity Theft Initiative. Vroom's orders were coming from ICE headquarters in Washington, D.C., from the highest echelons of the agency. Homan's man in charge of removals in Arizona was working in tandem with Vroom. If Homan had any issues with it at the time, he doesn't seem to have vocalized them. Speaking to the Arizona legislature a decade later, Homan's tune had changed. He blasted Alejandro Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary under Joe Biden, for supposedly telling ICE agents that you can't arrest someone for being here illegally unless he is convicted of a serious offense. Never mind that such a directive is a clear example of the same prosecutorial discretion that Homan had employed and defended years earlier. Now, empowered by Trump to be as cruel as he wanted to be, the mere idea of it struck Homan as borderline treasonous. Hulk Homan. In 2015, Barack Obama bestowed upon Homan the Presidential Rank Award for Distinguished Service, the highest honor a federal civil service employee can receive. Homan announced his retirement the following year, holding his official retirement party just days after Trump was inaugurated for the first time in 2017. At that point, the idea that Homan would cozy up to Trump struck his former colleagues as unlikely. In his 2020 book, Homan wrote that he was amazed and surprised by Trump's win, and happy for the men and women of ICE who would now be able to do their jobs without ridiculous policies that limited their abilities. But privately, former colleagues said, Homan was aghast at Trump's victory, or at least allowed them to believe as much. In no uncertain words, they remember, he told them that he thought Trump would destroy the country. That's not the way Homan tells it in his book or on the stump. In his book, Homan recounts how Trump's pick to lead DHS called him during his retirement party, relaying Trump's request that he postpone his retirement and become the next director of ICE, a two-step promotion, Homan noted. He took the gig, serving as acting ICE director until June 2018, when he resigned again due to family and personal considerations. In those 2 years, the meaner, crueler version of Homan took shape for public consumption. As acting ICE director, he was closely associated with Trump's zero-tolerance policy of prosecuting and removing anyone entering the country illegally, including immigrant parents who had brought their children with them. In 2022, The Atlantic called Homan the intellectual father of the policy of separating immigrant children from their parents as a means of deterring illegal entries. Both the Obama administration and Trump's first DHS secretary rejected that policy as inhumane, but it found purchase under Trump's second pick to head DHS, Kristen Nielsen. In May 2018, with family separations in full swing, a grimacing Homan attended a press conference in San Diego with then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions to formally announce the initiative. But zero tolerance, the polar opposite of the prosecutorial discretion that Homan once championed, soon proved to be a public relations nightmare for the Trump White House. Even Republicans and conservative religious leaders joined in its condemnation. Trump officially ended the practice via executive order in June of 2018. Homan still defends the program, which led to the separation of more than 5,500 children from their parents, according to one estimate. During an October 2024 interview with 60 Minutes, Homan blamed any hardship experienced by the children on their parents for entering the country illegally to begin with. Asked if there was a way to carry out Trump's mass deportation plans without family separation, Homan didn't blink. "Of course there is," he said. "Families can be deported together." It wasn't Homan's only bout of unnecessary cruelty as Trump's Iceman. As New Times previously reported, in December 2017, Homan reversed an ICE policy of presumptively releasing pregnant women who'd been arrested for immigration violations. Under Obama, Homan had authored a memo promising that pregnant women will generally not be detained by ICE. But under Trump, an illegal is an illegal, pregnant or not. Having stepped down as ICE honcho, Homan burnished his right-wing bona fides on Fox News, defending Trump and later denouncing Biden. He found the nonprofit group Border 911, which perpetuated the false trope that the U.S. was being invaded by immigrants. He headed up another, the American Project, devoted to funding election denialism. For the latter, according to its 2023 tax return, Homan received a salary of $110,769. Homan also started his own consulting firm, Homeland Strategic Consulting, which earned nearly $84,000 in fees during the 2021-22 campaign cycle, according to the nonprofit group OpenSecrets.org. Most of it from the failed U.S. Senate candidacy of Arizona Republican Jim Lehman. And Homan reportedly contributed to Project 2025, the uber-conservative Heritage Foundation massive blueprint for the second Trump administration. In his new role as Trump's border czar, Homan has defended and rationalized everything from ICE agents masking themselves to the detention of immigrants, criminal and non-criminal alike, in cruel hellholes like Florida's Alligator Alcatraz Detention Center and El Salvador's Terrorism Confinement Center. Is this the same Homan who once preached prosecutorial discretion and blessed the release of low-level criminal aliens from ICE custody? One former colleague said Homan seemed to be a positive influence when he worked for Obama. She now believes he was simply an opportunist, someone who sniffs out power and follows it wherever it goes. If she could ask Homan a question today, it would be, "What the fuck are you doing?" "He seemed genuine," said another colleague. "But when he started working for Trump the first go-around, I was like, are you kidding me?" A third colleague said she saw Homan in the same vein as Marco Rubio, J.D. Vance, and Lindsey Graham, formerly centrist Republican politicians who are on record as having described the things that they now support as being abominations. She pointed to Homan's recent appearance at a Turning Point USA event in Florida. Homan challenged a heckler to square off after his speech. "I guarantee you he sits down to pee," Homan said, to the delight of the crowd. The former associate had never seen that version of Homan in person. It was a caricature of himself. "Hulk Homan," she said with a sigh. Recent evolution or not, Hulk Homan figures to hang around. ICE just got a $75 billion budget infusion from Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, promising to make Trump's dark mass deportation dreams a reality, with an exponential boost in funding. That means more third-world-style arrests of grandmas and taco vendors, more incarceration spectacles like Alligator Alcatraz, and more deportation flights to countries like South Sudan, El Salvador, and the tiny African nation of Eswatini. It means job security for anyone willing to cast aside previous beliefs and zealously enact Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. The lure of power, status, and attention on Homan seems clear to his former colleagues. One former Homan colleague thought of Lord Acton's famous dictum, that power corrupts, and that absolute power corrupts absolutely, before offering her own take. "I think power reveals," she said, and I think that's what we're dealing with here. This story is part of the Arizona Watchdog Project, a year-long reporting effort led by New Times and supported by the Trace Foundation, in partnership with Deep South Today. Next, a story written by Jared McDonald Evoy of the Arizona Mirror and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on July 28th. Phoenix may get Tesla robo-taxis, an expert calls, completely defective. Tesla wants to bring autonomous robo-taxis to Arizona, despite safety concerns from critics. On August 8th, representatives from the governor's office, Arizona Department of Public Safety, state universities, and the Arizona Department of Transportation, among others, are set to meet with Tesla behind closed doors to discuss their application to bring robo-taxis to the Grand Canyon state. "There are many, 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 many serious problems," Dan O'Dowd, founder of the Dawn Project and prolific Tesla critic, told the Arizona Mirror about Tesla's self-driving and assisted driving technology. O'Dowd, an engineer who has created operating systems used in military aircraft, such as the F-35 and B-1B, has been conducting tests on Tesla's technology and sounding the alarm about what he says is a dangerous product being tested on the roadways. The president and CEO of Green Hill Software, O'Dowd, unsuccessfully ran for U.S. Senate in 2022, with a campaign focused on criticism of Tesla's automated driving systems. Tesla recently applied to bring its autonomous robo-taxis to Arizona, which would allow the company to conduct testing and operations with and without human drivers, in a similar fashion to what Waymo has done in Phoenix. The Self-Driving Vehicle Oversight Committee, a public body created under Governor Doug Ducey in 2015 to advise ADOT and the governor's office, was disbanded after only two public meetings and renamed the Connected and Automated Vehicle Team. The team serves in an informal, information-sharing role and doesn't make decisions on applications to operate autonomous vehicles, ADOT spokesman Bill Lamoureux told the Mirror. This arrangement has been in place since the Arizona Self-Driving Vehicle Oversight Committee, created in 2015, concluded its work during the previous administration. The group typically has discussions monthly. That previous committee has a record of one public meeting in 2016. But according to ADOT, the committee met twice before wrapping up its work and becoming the CAV team. The CAV team, which is an informal working group, has no requirement for attendance and no concrete list of members. But membership includes many of the same people who were on the previous committee, including ADOT, DPS, and representatives from the governor's office. The August 8th closed-door meeting with Tesla comes as the company is facing increased scrutiny from people like O'Dowd, who are concerned about a growing number of incidents involving Teslas and their self-driving technology, while regulators appear to be asleep at the wheel. They should at least do a minimal test to verify this, O'Dowd said of state and federal regulators. All of our tests are reproducible tests, and there is catastrophic failure. And data analyzed by the Mirror shows that Tesla already has a track record of issues in the state. Patchwork of regulations. Laws and regulations that govern automated vehicles differ vastly from state to state. And the federal government has regulations of its own via the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which often has powers that states do not, like being able to issue certain types of vehicle recalls. Those factors make for a confusing landscape for companies and policymakers alike. Back in 2015, Ducey signed an executive order allowing for the first testing and operation of autonomous vehicles in the state. 3 years later, an Uber self-driving car killed Elaine Herzberg, and shortly after, Ducey signed another executive order that put more regulations in place on testing the tech. Since 2015, Arizona has seen a boom in companies that are testing autonomous vehicles on its roads. ADOT currently lists Aurora, Beep, Cruise, Gatik, May Mobility, Nikola, Pony.ai, Neuro, Stack, Torque, Wabi, and Waymo as all testing in the state. Waymo first started testing in Arizona in 2017, but it kept employees behind the wheel and in the passenger seat to monitor the autonomous driver. It wasn't until 2020 that the company began operating its vehicles fully autonomously, eventually offering the service via an app available to users within a certain geographic area of Phoenix. But there is more to the technology than just autonomous vehicles. The systems. Automated driving systems, also known as ADS, is the technology used to describe what most would recognize as a robo-taxi or fully autonomous vehicle. The Waymo cars that drive around downtown Phoenix use ADS technology. Alternatively, Advanced Driver Assistance Systems, or ADAS for short, only assist a driver who is expected to remain responsible for driving the car. This can include systems like adaptive cruise control, blind spot detection, parking assistance, and any system that assists the driver. The autopilot and self-driving functions on Tesla vehicles are considered ADAS and not ADS systems. The NHTSA keeps track of incidents reported to them that involve both ADS and ADAS systems. A review of that data by the Mirror found that of the 97 incidents involving ADAS systems in Arizona that were reported from 2021, when the reporting period started, to May of this year, 81 of them involved a Tesla. The data on the incidents is also largely incomplete, as the section which contains information on which version of the system being used in the incident says, redacted, may contain confidential business information. Doesn't recognize a school bus. O'Dowd's group made national and international headlines recently when it performed a test on a Tesla in Austin, an area where the company is looking to deploy its robo-taxis. The test had a Tesla driving down a road toward a school bus, which had its stop sign out, and a series of dummies dressed as children nearby. As the Tesla in self-driving mode got closer, it didn't slow down. Then, a member of O'Dowd's team pulled a string to make one of the dummies dart out in front of the Tesla. The Tesla never stopped. His group has performed similar tests multiple times since the first in 2023, which turned out to be prophetic. In 2023, O'Dowd's group bought time during the Super Bowl to air an ad showing its findings of how Tesla's self-driving mode ignored do not enter signs and school bus stop signs. Tesla CEO Elon Musk responded online that the ad would boost the brand. A month later, 17-year-old Tillman Mitchell was hit by a Tesla while exiting a school bus. The Tesla that hit him was allegedly in self-driving mode. I don't think they've even worked on it, because we did a New York Times full-page ad disclosing the school bus thing. Tesla ignored us, O'Dowd said. We went out and pushed that everywhere. Still, nobody has taken any action. Tesla did not respond to questions about O'Dowd's research. O'Dowd has been conducting research into Tesla for years now, and he's concerned that the technology is being falsely marketed to consumers as safe. In one incident in 2022, a Tesla in the full self-driving mode in Santa Barbara began to make a left turn into oncoming traffic. O'Dowd has even hired driving instructors to take a Tesla on the same route a teenager would follow for their driving test. The Tesla had four failures that the driving instructor said would have been auto fails for a human. We can't let this stand. We can't just let somebody get away with building completely defective products, O'Dowd said. We have to do it without them. Self-driving cars are here to stay. In places like San Francisco, they're a major tourist attraction. But regulation remains patchworked, and the future is not entirely clear on how the technology will be overseen by state and federal governments. Regulators need to have recall authority. Mark McCarthy, an expert at the Brookings Institute with a focus on technology, law, and policy, told the Mirror. There should also be liability on the manufacturer for unreasonable driving performance of their self-driving cars. One of the major pushes behind self-driving technology is that it will make roadways safer as it removes human error from driving. However, McCarthy has pointed out that may not be entirely the case. Last year, the Association for Computing Machinery warned policymakers that they should not make this assumption because, simply put, computers make mistakes that humans don't. Additionally, the code for the machines is written by fallible human beings. McCarthy said that a third layer of protection for consumers in this space is proactive regulation, where an entity like the NHTSA would make sure that self-driving vehicles meet certain standards. That is nowhere in sight at this point, but it will have to happen at some point, McCarthy said. Data analyzed by the Mirror found that Waymo vehicles make up 337 of the 403 incident reports in the NHTSA ADS database in Arizona from 2001 to May of this year. The majority of those incidents are caused by human error when a human-driven car collides with a Waymo. O'Dowd said that he gives Waymo credit for starting cautiously and developing its tech with employees rather than testing it with civilians. He said that he plans to continue testing Tesla's features and trying to bring his concerns to regulators. He's already sent his findings to Congress, Tesla, and a number of other agencies. The regulators knew about that problem, did a detailed study, but then did nothing, O'Dowd said, referencing an issue found with Tesla's autopilot feature by the NHTSA. We have to do it without them. Remember that if you miss any of the stories in this program or any other SunSounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on On-Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. someone kept calling the cops on protesters at Abe Hamada's office. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on July 29th. Roughly once a week for 2 months earlier this year, a sizable group of protesters demonstrated outside the surprise office of Republican Representative Abe Hamada, the MAGA devotee and election denier who won his first term in office last November. They were careful to stay on public sidewalks and not impede traffic or access to the office, as they expressed their displeasure with Hamada's support for President Donald Trump. Despite that, records show, the police were called on protesters at least 7 times during that span. Surprise police, which sometimes responded with multiple vehicles and officers, never found any evidence of wrongdoing. In one instance, a protester's car was towed at the behest of a member of Hamada's staff. At the same time, pro-Hamada demonstrators were given preferential access and were never treated as a threat to public safety. Speaking to those supporters, Hamada painted the mostly senior citizen-led group of anti-Trump protesters, with whom he refused to meet, as brainwashed, and falsely claimed that they were professional agitators, paid by liberal billionaire George Soros. The anti-Trump protesters were organized by Northwest Valley Indivisible, a local chapter of the larger anti-Trump grassroots Indivisible movement. For about 2 months, starting in mid-February, they demonstrated outside Hamada's office to demand that he hold a public town hall. The protests attracted between 30 and 100 people, mostly elderly, with 52-year-old organizer Brent Peake, one of the youngest participants, and would last roughly an hour. But as soon as their protests began, so did regular calls to surprise police about them. Hamada's office, which is located at 12515 West Bell Road in Surprise, shares a building with the home care services company Total Care Connections. Total Care's founder, Daniel Stringer, rents the place, which, at least earlier this year, still bore the name of former Representative Debbie Lesko above the entrance to Hamada's office. According to police records, Stringer called police about the protesters of February 19th, despite there being no evidence of any lawbreaking. Police arrived to speak with Peake, and a police drone was mobilized to oversee the small gathering, but nothing violent was reported. Stringer declined to comment when reached by Phoenix New Times. There were no calls to police the next 2 times protesters demonstrated. After that, though, police were called like clockwork. Exactly who called is not clear. Names were redacted from police records about subsequent protests that were released to New Times. On March 24th, 2 calls were made to surprise police by someone reporting that their view was blocked by signs being held in the area. 6 officers responded to the crowd of approximately 70 people, but nothing criminal was observed, according to the police report. The next week, police received a call that signs were blocking the view of a vehicle. This time, 12 police officers responded to the crowd of approximately 100 people. Again, nothing criminal was observed or reported, per a police report. On April 14th, pro-Hamada protesters began to counter-protest at Hamada's office. Lisa Everett, the chair of the Legislative District 29 Republicans, told New Times that she heard about the protest, and I was like, no, we can't let that stand. Police also responded to that protest and 2 subsequent demonstrations between pro- and anti-Hamada protesters, but served more as crowd control. Police reports again state nothing criminal was observed or reported. Lot for me, not for thee. However, pro-Hamada protesters were treated much differently than anti-Hamada demonstrators, especially when it came to who could use the property's parking lot. No police were called during a March 17th protest, but a tow truck was. Demonstrators were told they could not park in the building's parking lot, as it was private property. As if to emphasize that point, a Western towing truck began to show up while protesters were there, waiting for someone to slip up. The next week, 76-year-old Sun City resident Pat Tonema slipped up. She parked her Ford Escape in the building's lot and walked over to join the protest with a few of her friends. But Tonema said that it wasn't more than 5 minutes before Peek announced over a bullhorn that someone's car was being towed. "I didn't even go 20 feet," Tonema told New Times. "And I saw my car being towed away. A tow truck was there lurking in the parking lot and saw us get out of the car and walk over to the protest and snatched it up." After her car was towed, Tonema said, she spoke to Hammond's district director, Joshua Lyons. Lyons told her that he had no idea who towed from their parking lot, but he would find out for me, Tonema recalled. He added that he'd find a wealthy donor of Abe Hammond to reimburse her for the $160 towing fee. However, according to surprise police records, Lyons knew exactly who had authorized the tow for unauthorized parking. It was him. Tonema said that she was never reimbursed. Neither Lyons nor anyone else from Hammond's office responded to questions from New Times. "I just never assumed that a congressman would tow cars from his office parking lot," Tonema said. "It didn't even occur to me." Nothing legally prevented Tonema's car from being towed. She was parked on private property. However, pro-Hammond constituents were not restricted from using the parking lot in the same way. On the same day Tonema's car was towed, a pro-Hammond resident walked through the crowd of protesters calling them dirtbag liberals and fucking idiots, according to video shared with New Times. Peek said the man parked his car in Hammond's lot, but was not towed. Once pro-Hammond protesters began regularly showing up at the demonstrations, the lurking tow trucks disappeared. Pro-Hammond protesters parked in the lot with no issue, Peek said. Photos shared with the New Times even show a pop-up tent selling MAGA merchandise set up in the lot. New tactics. At one April protest, Hammond came out and spoke with supporters after Indivisible protesters had left. In a video interview with MAAP Real Talk Show Media, Hammond described the Indivisible protesters as brainwashed and said he's not going to negotiate with paid protesters whose sole purpose is to create a narrative that isn't there. "They don't know what they're protesting," Hammond continues. "It's Soros-aligned. This is how the left operates. We know their game." Peek, Tonema, and others scoffed at the claim, calling it ridiculous. Throughout history, there are constant claims of being paid protesters, as though people don't have enough brains and heart to figure out what wrong is being done, Tonema said. "I'm surprised people even say it anymore. It's embarrassing." What the protesters want, they say, is for Hammond to engage with all of his constituents, not just the ones who agree with him. However, after a protest on April 28th, the group gave up on confronting Hammond at his office. "I'm kind of done asking for a town hall," Peek said. "I don't think he's ever going to do it." Instead, the Indivisible protesters launched a Step Up CD8 initiative on May 10th, holding simultaneous protests at 5 locations across Hammond's district. More than 5,700 people showed up for the group's 7 No King's Day protests across the district on June 14th. Indivisible continues to hold protests and letter drop events throughout the area. Now that they're no longer protesting in front of Hammond's office, protesters say they don't face the same level of hostility. Counter-protesters haven't shown up, and attendees feel comfortable taking their eyes off their cars. But the petty annoyances of trying to get Hamada's attention haven't been completely forgotten. When Tonoma protests, she holds up a sign to passing cars on Lake Pleasant Parkway. It reads, "Hamada had my car towed." Next, a story written by Zach Buchanan and posted on August 1st. Disturbing. Trans woman forced to share Sky Harbor bathroom with Carrie Lake. Editor's note, this story has been updated to include a statement from Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. Using the restroom at an airport is already harrowing enough. There's never enough soap or paper towels, and with flights to catch, every bit of bathroom business is conducted on a tight clock. It's also conducted on some of the planet's most worldly porcelain, with every toilet welcoming thousands of strange butts from across the country and the world every single day. Not to mention the public safety threats who walk into public bathrooms in open-toed shoes. But imagine you enter the airport bathroom ready to face the international germ gauntlet only to encounter one of Arizona's most hostile organisms, Carrie Lake. Such a run-in occurred Thursday night at Sky Harbor International Airport, at least if Lake's social media account is to be believed. Near 11 p.m. that night, Lake tagged the airport in a tweet to complain that she, quote, "just had to share the women's restroom with a man." "So disturbing," Lake added, Trumpian capitalization and all. "When will this insanity end?" Lake was presumably referring in her caustically transphobic way to encountering a transgender woman in the bathroom. Phoenix New Times reached out to Lake for clarification via the federal agency she oversees, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, but has not heard back. Sky Harbor spokesperson John Brodsky told New Times via email that the airport is aware of the tweet and that Phoenix Sky Harbor follows all non-discrimination laws, including gender identity protections, and is proud to provide a respectful, inclusive, and accessible environment for all travelers. Assuming her tweet actually means what it clearly implies, Lake is adding to what's been quite a bigoted run recently. Last month, Lake used a congressional hearing to float a homophobic rumor about Democratic Representative Greg Stanton. With her tweet Thursday night, Lake returned to a frequently plumbed well by her and many others in the MAGA movement of scaremongering about trans people in public restrooms. To be clear, there is little evidence to suggest that trans people using the restrooms that match their identities is a public safety risk. A 2018 study found that reports of privacy and safety violations in public restrooms, locker rooms, and changing rooms involving trans people are exceedingly rare. On the other hand, a 2019 study of students found that trans students who are forced to use bathrooms that do not align with their identities, i.e., a trans man forced to use the women's restroom and a trans woman forced to use the men's, are at greater risk of sexual assault. When people like Lake accost or draw attention to trans people for using bathrooms that align with their identities, it leaves trans people feeling unsafe using the restroom anywhere. Unlike many states, Arizona does not have a law that restricts the restrooms that trans people may use, though Republican lawmakers have repeatedly tried to pass one. Arizona does have a law restricting trans girls from participating in girl sports, though the law currently is barred from being enforced during a legal challenge. Like instances of trans assaults on cisgender people in restrooms, instances of trans girls playing sports, much less dominating them, are incredibly rare. Lake does not claim that the trans woman she encountered did anything to threaten her safety or privacy, other than simply existing, that is. Lake might remember that the next time she finds herself in a similar situation and just leave people alone. And if you're a trans woman who encounters Lake in a restroom, please tune your eyes to the level of soft focus that she prefers for all public appearances. After all, Carrie Lake is entitled to her privacy too. And as we near the end of the program, let's take time to take one quick look at this story written by Sam Eifling and posted on August 1st. Big Freedia, Todrick Hall, will headline Phoenix Pride in October. Resistance and power are the themes of this year's Phoenix Pride, which announced its schedule and entertainment lineups on Friday. Big Freedia, Snow the Product, Todrick Hall, and Debbie Holiday will headline the two-day festival. DJ Sammy J. Sanchez will spin 4 hours of dance music on Sunday afternoon for anyone left standing after Big Freedia blows out the Saturday main stage. The worldwide ambassador of New Orleans Bounce has been on a gospel kick lately. She's dropping a new album on August 8th, as if she needed to enlist any Holy Spirits to get people moving. Phoenix Pride is scheduled for October 18th and 19th. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.